let people know who you are. Give us a little background, Matt.
Sure. I'm a writer from Michigan. I lived in Michigan my whole life until 2 years ago. I moved to Arizona for a teach at Arizona State University in the MFA program there. My newest novel, Scrapper, is my sixth book and my second novel, which just came out in September.
Are your roots actually in the Detroit area?
They're not. My parents live 2 hours north of Detroit in a very small town called Hemlock, between Saginaw and Midland.
Okay.
So I lived in that area until I was about 26, and then I was in Ann Arbor for five years or so. And then I taught at Northern Michigan University in the Upper Peninsula for a couple of years. So I spent a lot of time in Detroit, but never lived there.
So you went from deep snow to no snow.
Deep snow to no snow. Yeah. The day I had my job interview here at Arizona State, it was over 100 degrees warmer than it was when I left home in Marquette.
Wow.
Which barely really seems possible.
Well, I've been to Arizona and it is beautiful, but
I've
spent a lot of time in Marquette too.
Great.
I love the UP. You don't miss it?
Oh, I miss it terribly. And I miss the people we lived there with. We liked very much, but it's been really good here. This has been a good move for my wife and I. And I think I'm really glad to teach at Arizona State, which I enjoy quite a bit.
So we're talking about Scrapper today. So give us start us off. Where did the seed of the idea come from?
Sure. When I was finishing my novel before this, In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods, which has this sort of, it's a less realist setting. It's a more of a mythic setting, almost in this sort of like pocket universe. And I was finishing that book sort of in the, I don't know, in the middle of the like 2012 election season.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty aware that that the novel I was writing didn't have a lot of space for sort of the cultural and political concerns that, you know, are part of my everyday life. It does other stuff really well, but it couldn't do that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew I wanted to write something that could next. And I also had been thinking for a while about wanting to write something more explicitly set in Michigan. I think a lot of my work is sort of implicitly set there, but it often didn't name that. And around that same time, I saw a very short documentary clip that was at the New York Times by Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady, who
mm-hmm.
are documentary filmmakers. They made the movie Jesus Camp a couple years ago that got a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they were working on a documentary about Detroit. And there was this very short clip at the New York Times from that project about metal scrapping in Detroit. And it was really fascinating. And I just thought, like, that's a world that would be interesting to try to inhabit. And there's obvious stories there. And so that was really the seed. I was sort of looking for a story in Michigan, and then that particular subject presented itself. I really started with that. Before I had any of the plot, I had that landscape and that job, and that's really what I started writing about, long before I knew what the plot of the book would be.
So when you were starting work on this, did you spend any time yourself doing any scrapping or dumpster diving or going along with someone who did that?
I did not. Definitely not at the beginning, especially. Later, in the second draft of the book, I did a lot more of my in-person research. I was living in Marquette by then, and I came down and spent some time with a photographer who studies the sort of metal scrapping and does sort of attempts to like preserve buildings that are going to be subject to sort of destruction this way, both
mm-hmm.
before their damage and then also documents the damage. And so I spent time with him as part of that process. A lot of the research I'd done before that was based on either previous experience or books, and especially photographs and film. There's so much documentation, some of it very professional, some of it very not, of some of these places. And that was really fascinating to me. I probably did more research in person or with photographs and video than I did in books, partly because nonfiction books always come attached with someone else's interpretation. And I often wanted the landscape. I wanted the facts of the thing, but I didn't want someone else to interpret it for me. So it was interesting trying to separate that out from other people's narratives that they'd already imposed on that space.
I went along once with a friend who does some scrapping and dumpster diving because I was curious about it. And, you know, it's
uh-huh.
strangely addictive.
Yeah.
You take what is treat it as trash, you know, with something that is not going to have another life. And then, well, you don't necessarily give it another life, but you take it in someplace and they give you money.
Well, and it does have another life there. I mean, it's such a really complicated subject. And of course, like, you wouldn't want your house to be scavenged for metal, but, but the, you know, the copper that comes out of a building that's not in use anywhere in the world. I mean, you know, Detroit's an example here, but wherever that's happening, you know, ends up in a scrapyard, ends up being often shipped back around the world to China or India or other countries in that region where it's dismantled and repurposed. And it comes back to you in your iPhone, you know. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason we have some of the cheap electronics we have is because metal's being taken out of abandoned buildings in the U.S. Cheaper to get scrap-haired metal, ship it all the way around the world and back than it is to mine copper at this point, which is sort of unbelievable. I knew there was a time, I know less now than I did, but there's a time where I knew way, way too much about that particular cycle, which of course isn't really in the book, but I knew a lot about it for a period of time.
Kelly, the main character, he's got something of two personalities, the scrapper and the salver. If that's how you pronounce salver. And and as he goes through this process of scrapping in these abandoned, this blight area of Detroit, he comes across something of a surprise. Is there a synopsis you can give us without giving it away?
Yeah, I mean, I think that particular thing, I don't have a problem giving away. It's in the first sentence of the book in some ways. But Kelly is scrapping an abandoned house, and he goes down the basement to get the metal that would be down there. And he finds a young boy named Daniel, who's 10 or 11, who's been kidnapped and is sort of mysteriously held in this basement for 3 days. And so rescues him and becomes sort of a celebrated local hero, and then becomes obsessed with solving that crime, which sets off the sort of bigger plot of the book in many ways.
And Kelly himself, even in a relationship, he always seems to be very much alone and abandoned, something like the city that he's in. Is there a statement you're trying to make here about being silenced or abandoned, not having a voice?
I don't know in that way, although I think that's an interesting reading that I don't necessarily oppose. I think, you know, as you know from reading the book, Kelly has some things in his past that he's sort of hiding from or running from or doesn't want to be. And one at the beginning, as the book opens, his solution has been sort of to isolate himself, like to be with other people is to both to be in danger and to put people in danger. Yeah. And so he's isolated himself. And I think one of the things that keeps him from having a better outcome in the book than he does is his inability to fully join both relationships and the communities that he's offered. I mean, as you know, there's sort of in the early parts of the book, he goes to a church over and over. He goes to a support group. He tries to join these other men who are metal scrapping. Eventually, there's some stuff with the neighborhood watches. Then, of course, his relationship with Jackie and Daniel. And it's his inability. In some ways, like he remains alone even with others. And I think it in some ways has the opposite effect. It leaves him dangerous in a way that if there was a chance to more fully be with people, maybe he wouldn't be that way.
That's kind of interesting that in his romantic relationship, he doesn't refer to her as Jackie very often. It's always the girl with the limp.
Yeah, there's something about naming in the book, I think, in general. Like Kelly doesn't always use the names for people. He sometimes doesn't think of himself as a name very much. Kelly's name actually isn't in the book as much as it could be. There's sort of an attempt to use pronouns more than as much as I can. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes out of a childhood belief of his, which is sort of which goes all the way back to sort of his religious upbringing and like Genesis kind of stuff. Like the very, very first thing in the Bible that man is asked to do is to name everything, that he's given this sort of world where nothing is named and is asked to go and name everything. And to name something is to know it and to own it and maybe to love it. And I think Kelly believed that. And there's something that's happened to him in his trauma that reverses that a little bit too, that he doesn't know things as fully as he wants to. And so the naming is attached to that. I think it's less explicit than maybe I just made it in the book. But I think that's part of it. I think the naming is a powerful thing and he's not always capable of naming something.
Now, a writer in the writing process has to become his character and inhabit him. What did becoming Kelly cost you or teach you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think this book was really difficult in a lot of ways. I mean, as you know, it's sort of the topic of the book is really heavy. Kelly's a heavy person who does some dangerous and maybe unlikable things. I think it was hard. I think, you know, in some ways, one of the ways that I generate character often is to both see them with some things you share and also to get the character in a place where they're taking actions you wouldn't take. And as soon as they start doing that, they're unknowable a little bit, right? You no longer fully, their motivations are no longer your motivations. Mm-hmm. So there is that part of the process. I think, you know, from day to day, mostly I was okay being in that space. At the very end of every draft of the book, I work really long hours. And the last draft of the book, I was working 6 to 10 hour days, like 5 or 6 days a week in like Upper Peninsula, Northern Michigan winter, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was pretty heavy material to spend with in that environment at that time. But I don't know. Like, I think there's that if you're going to ask a reader to inhabit this space, it seems like you should fully inhabit it yourself first. But I do think that one of the things I learned writing this book, as opposed to the last book, which was had a more of a kind of mythic fairy tale kind of take on its violence, the realist violence was harder to write and harder to be a part of, harder to inhabit. And I've been thinking about that a lot. And I don't know that I have an answer to that yet, except that there's a way in which the sort of mythic voices allow you to insert some distance that my realist voice does not. And I don't know. I'm curious about that. It's something I'm continuing to think about and maybe will influence future work in certain ways.
Now, you said before that easy writing isn't worth the effort, and yours isn't. It's complex, it's dense, it's thoughtful. At times, I'd even call it poetic. Mm-hmm. And others have described it as dreamlike. Mm-hmm. Talk about the kind of writing that you admire. What do you aspire to, your role models?
I think one of the – I mean, I was always a reader growing up, right? And I read a lot of different things. And I think if you'd asked me when I was 10 or 15 or 18 what the purpose of writing was, and I think I would have talked more about sort of escapist sort of pleasures, which are totally valid and is definitely a part of the reading landscape that's useful. And I think all good books have that to some extent. But at some point, I started reading more literary fiction, which for me, some of those entry points were people like Dennis Johnson and Amy Hempel and Raymond Carver and Colson Whitehead, people like that I was reading when I was 20 or so. And I realized that these were books that weren't escapist, that in fact actually were getting me like closer to my life, that somehow like that art experience brought you closer to what you really felt and thought and closer to your real sort of moral center. And as soon as I saw that, I didn't want the other thing anymore as much, you know, like I mm-hmm. wanted more of that. I wanted art that made me more present in my life and more present in my sort of heart and mind. And so I think that's the goal, is like not to take people away from life, but try to get people closer to it. And so that's part of the overall thing. And then I think at like the sentence level, I care a lot about the acoustics of language. I care a lot about how it sounds. I care a lot about, even if a person never hears it out loud, I think there's a physicality to prose that's worth having. Gary Lutz talks about the difference between page turning prose and page hugging prose. There's a kind of prose that's invisible that you can just, you know, that you just turn through. And then there's a kind of prose that asks you to stay inside it, to hug the page instead of turn it, and to maybe move more slowly. And I obviously probably a page hugging writer, or at least aspire to be. And, you know, there's good and bad to both. And of course you have to find other ways to propel the reader and keep them moving, even in that kind of prose.
And you've been called a brave writer, too. I wonder how you see that. Why do you think that is? Personally, I think that all writing requires courage. And the more vulnerable you make yourself as a writer, the more powerful your writing becomes. But how do you think about that when people call you a brave writer?
Yeah, I mean, I like what you just said about it quite a bit. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I think about it that way all the time. I think, because in some ways, like the act of writing itself is, especially at this point in my life, like a pretty privileged, cushy thing I get to do. You know, I sit in my office at home and make things up for a couple hours a day. Like, that doesn't seem entirely courageous. But I think there is, it is difficult to say things that other people don't want to hear. It's difficult to look at things that it's easier to look away from. There's definitely courage in that. There's courage in a bearing witness.
And no matter who you're writing about, you're revealing yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think to show who you really are in the life you're leading, in the place and time you live, is always an act of courage in some ways. But I think it's a, it's relative, of course, to other ways of living in the world too. It's a lucky thing to get to do, and I'm pretty aware of that. But I think that's also part of the, I think about that a lot, and the responsibilities of that. And I think to use that time well, and for things that are purposeful and meaningful, seems like an important part of that thing that you have to maintain all the time. Like, it'd be easy to fritter it away or just to make another clever thing instead of like trying to do work that felt to me like it mattered.
And perhaps one of the reasons I'm going to guess that you've been called a brave writer is because you're certainly not formula, and you take some risks,
sure,
some literary risks, and you do that in Scrapper as well. When I was reading it, it would throw me out, but it would also give me pause and make me think. You have these interesting interludes, these mm-hmm. little stories separate from Scrapper, and yet maybe not separate. There's a story about a music rapper. There's a story about a detainee in Guantanamo. You take us to Trayvon Martin's mm-hmm. killer, and they don't really seem to have anything to do with this story. So that's kind of a courageous literary risk, I think, you took there. You want to talk about that
sure.
craft
yeah,
there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, obviously the book has sort of political and moral dimensions to it. And I think one of the things about writing sort of overtly political fiction is that whatever ideas the book is going to hold pretty much have to get filtered through character. Like, it's in some ways, otherwise you're writing a polemic or you're writing an essay or you're doing something else, which is all fine, but not what novels are. And so as eventually the book sort of acquires a little bit of a tunnel vision, it can only contain thoughts that Kelly can reasonably have or portray. But I don't think that means the book has to be small. Like, it feels to me that there's ways to expand the scope of the book beyond Kelly's story without leaving it entirely. And it seems to, in my mind at least, all of those interludes thematically resonate and are meant to hopefully show other places in the world that are maybe ruled by similar cycles of trauma and fear and violence. And I will say, I think, I knew that was a risk, and it certainly has been sort of review-wise and stuff. I think that's maybe the thing that's most commonly sort of pointed out as a negative.
Is it always pointed out as a negative?
I was
skimming some, and some of them are positive. It's like, okay, yeah, he's done something interesting.
There's lots of good reviews. Yeah. But yeah. And people are interested in it. They are. I think you're right. And individual readers have been really interested in it. For me, the risk has paid off in that if the worst thing that happens is a person is sort of thrown out of the story by it for a minute, and they're forced to think about how what they're reading relates to Guantanamo Bay and Trayvon Martin and Chernobyl, that's a win for me. I don't know. Like, I think even if it's discomforting or if it's occasionally off-putting, like, I'm glad those things are part of the conversation of my book, if that makes sense. They've been part of the conversation of my speaking. People ask about in Q&As. I get to make those bigger connections between the stories in Detroit and these other sort of national and global stories. Yeah, so I don't know. I knew it was a risk. I was tempted to take them out. I wrote them very, very late in the process of some of the last things I wrote. And in the end, I'm very glad they're there, even if they do occasionally bristle the wrong way.
And right now, actually, you just had another book come out, and that was a nonfiction book mm-hmm. also this year, Baldur's Gate. Now, I'm not a gaming person,
sure, yeah.
so that's quite alien to me. But
right.
go ahead and tell us a little bit about that one, too.
Sure. It's a book I wrote for a press called Boss Fight Books, which does nonfiction books about single classic video games. And they're always sort of a blend of memoir and criticism. So I wrote about a book called Baldur's Gate 2, which is a important computer role-playing game that came out in the year 2000, set in the Dungeons and Dragons world. And it's sort of very influential. It's sort of formative to games that come after it. But it was also something I spent a lot of time with at the time of it came out. And so the book in some ways is both about that game and trying to, it's a very story-based game in some ways, an attempt to make this big living world. And so trying to apply some of my novelist's eye toward the sort of story and systems of that game, like how it's built and how it differs to build something that is nonlinear and where the reader or the player can go anywhere and experience things in any order. And, you know, and then also to think about the memoir part of it has to do with growing up as a gamer and as a person who played Dungeons & Dragons, who's really into like fantasy and sci-fi. And at some point in my life has tried to, at various points in my life, I think tried to deny that part of my personality or that part of my life to various extents, you know, in an attempt to grow up or to be serious or to be a writer. And of course, really like reconciling those things is better. There's the work that I was in my first book of stories pretty much came alive because I started allowing myself those more, I don't know, more fantastical thoughts and the more science fiction kind of urges and being honest that that's a part of my personality and part of the reason I'm a reader and a writer. And so the book is sort of about that as well, that I think I've spent a long time trying maybe not to be the person I actually am, right? As many of us do. And yeah, so it was fun to write in that way. To get to inhabit that space more directly and sort of try to deal with those anxieties. All of which, of course, like are barely even real anxieties anymore because like, you know, I'm 35. And when I was a kid, that stuff was nerdier. And it's there's still some elements of that to it. But like lots of people play video games now. All of our popular culture stuff is fantasy and sci-fi and comic books. Like, I mean, like all the things that were somehow shameful to me when I was 12 are now what like everybody does.
Yeah.
And so it's crazy to still be like trying to squirrel that away in some way, you know.
So do you think that world and its storytelling, is that still facing life or escaping it? Or with your stories, can you help people face something in their lives through writing about it?
You know, it's funny because I think it can be both. I think, you know, you think about things like fairy tales and myths, which are, of course, not set in an objective, you know, realist world, whatever that means, you know, without going down that rabbit hole, but like, but have always been incredibly helpful to people for thinking through their lives and for seeing life as it really is. And I think that can be done. I think where it fails is when an escapist piece of entertainment only, it doesn't challenge you in any way. It doesn't ask you to reconsider. It doesn't ask you to inhabit something you wouldn't normally. If all it's doing is just reinforcing like societal norms an easy, untrue way of looking at the world, but it does that with like elves or something, then that, right, that's just pure escapism. But certainly you can use those spaces really well, and there can be really interesting things happening there. And there's definitely science fiction and fantasy writers that ask a lot of their readers and ask a lot of the world around them. And so of course it's not a matter of genre versus literary as much as it is the caliber of both, because there's certainly literary fiction also and realist fiction that is just as much fantasy, right? Where like nothing in it is sort of, it's not doing that kind of deep inquiry, I think, into life that it could be.
So the whole idea behind this is there's a game by that name, and if somebody is playing that game and they want to learn more about the character, they would read the book. Is that how it works?
Yeah, to some extent. The game, you make your own character in the game, and then you sort of play through the story. So there is sort of a character you're inhabiting, but you get to design a lot of it. And of course, you're defining what happens in the story by your choices, right? It can turn out in different ways. You can certainly do things in different modes. But so some of the things I'm trying to think through really hard are like the way the story is built. Think about the morality of it a little bit. This is a common thing in video games, but the story in the game, to really, really briefly, there's this big theme throughout the game where the game is telling you that you're resisting this sort of evil in you and you're trying to be like a good person and a hero and you're trying to protect the world. But of course, like it's a game built around like combat. And so like by the end of the game, like you've probably done more killing than anyone you meet, right? and there's sort of like, there's like a disconnect between like the story is telling you and then what the game is asking you to do. And some of it is like thinking through some of those things and just trying to, yeah, be mindful of that in a certain way. And it is interesting. And there's often a disconnect between game systems and game stories. And I think it's something people are always trying to solve. And there's actually a lot of games that do really interesting things with that now, where they're sort of using that, they're subverting your expectations, right? And this game was very, very progressive story-wise at the time. And, you know, it's 15 years old, so it's aged in different ways. But yeah, it was really interesting to sort of get to stay inside some of those modes and think about them.
Well, that's interesting. I'd never thought about gaming and literary arts and storytelling, but, you know, what you're saying makes sense.
Well, so many writers have grown up with that now, you know. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think let's say a lot of writers my age are going to be people who grew up with that. I think in the same way that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you had people like Michael Chabon and Jonathan Lethem and that group, like sort of really like inhabiting like comic books in a literary sense, right? Like this thing that was very disreputable 30 years before in literary circles becomes reputable partly or interesting just because it's the stuff of childhood for a certain generation of writers. And I think games are probably going to be that to some extent for my generation.
Yeah. Well, you're a prolific writer, Matt. What are you working on next? I'm sure there's something.
Yeah, I've got a finishing up actually this week, hopefully the last edits on a short story collection that'll be out next year.
Nice.
Yeah, thank you. In the fall, and then finding my way into the next novel, which will be hopefully go well. But yeah, just starting on that, so it's pretty early.
So you know that one's going to be already, or
I think so. I have as many novels fall apart than succeed. So I've had a couple between In the House and Scrapper, I wrote two half novels that I abandoned, and I'm on my third novel start since Scrapper. So I think this one's going to go the distance, but you know, maybe I won't count that chicken quite yet.
All right, I hear you. Well, thanks for talking with us, Matt. Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you so much.